person, do you see anything? They say, no, I don't see anything. And they say, well, okay, you don't see anything. But just tell me, what do you guess? Is it a cross or a circle? And the person will make the right choice. And they'll say, yeah, it's a cross. If it's a cross, it's a circle. If it's a circle. If you put over here a picture, let's say, of a house on fire, and you put over here in another portion of the blind visual field, a picture of a house that's not on fire, all of this in the blind area, and you ask the person, what do you see? They'll say, you see nothing. And they'll say, okay, you see nothing, but extend your hand to some place where it won't get burned. Okay, and then the person will extend their hand here, not here. And there's a whole pile of stuff like this. So that's the phenomenon called blind sight. Well, here there's obviously a kind of problem arising for this rule-following business. Because if you take Quine seriously, you'd have to say that the person with blind sight, there's every reason to believe that the person is perceiving the cross and the circle and the house on fire just the way he did before. He just doesn't have any awareness of it. And Quine would be forced to say, and Dummett and so on, that the person is no longer following rules, even though he's doing exactly what he did before. And that, Searle recognizes, would be kind of paradoxical, and he doesn't want to draw that conclusion. So he introduces a distinction between what he calls blockage and inaccessibility. In principle. Okay, so that's a distinction. In the case of the man who with blind sight, he only has something called blockage. That is, he doesn't have inaccessibility in principle to the to what he's perceiving. It's just some interference, you know, blockage. So now we have that distinction. On the other hand, in the case of Peter, following the rules of the binding theory, it's inaccessibility in principle. Okay. Well, suppose we pursue this argument further, and let's go back to the Martian who talks English and has complete access to all the rules. Remember, for the Martian, there was no problem. The Martian was like, had accessibility to the rules. Suppose the Martian has a brain injury, okay, and now he's just like the person with blind sight. He keeps talking exactly the way he talked before, which by assumption is the same way we do. He acts just like before, but he's lost the inner eye. You know, the brain injury has eliminated his ability to access the computations. Okay. Now, according to Searle, this has got to be blockage. It can't be inaccessibility in principle, right? That's exactly the same case. Just as the person who's with brain damage lost access to awareness but is acting as before and therefore only has blockage, the Martian, who through a comparable brain injury has lost access, only has blockage, not inaccessibility in principle. So the Martian is still following the rules, just as the guy with blind sight is still seeing, but without awareness, okay? Suppose now that, notice that the Martian is now indistinguishable from us. In fact, this brain injury might have turned the Martian into a human. In fact, that's exactly what it might have done. In fact, suppose the Martian had some little component up there, which was what was making it possible for the Martian to inspect his computations and say, yeah, it's binding theory. And suppose the operation just cut that out. Well, now the Martian's indistinguishable from humans, but the Martian only has blockage and is still following the rules, while the human is not following the rules because of inaccessibility in principle. Now let's carry it a step further. Suppose that among Martians, somebody's born with a certain genetic defect, and the genetic defect makes the guy indistinguishable from the person with the brain injury. Okay? In other words, the genetic defect just didn't allow that part of the brain to grow. Well, what about this person? This person is now identical with the Martian with blockage and identical to Peter, but it wasn't caused by a brain injury, it was caused by the genes. Well, presumably, we have to decide what we're going to say in this case. Unless we want to return to absurdity, we would have to say that the Martian with the genetic defect still just has blockage. He's exactly like the other Martians, but something went wrong with his brain, even though he's now born identical with humans. Suppose now that this genetic defect is perpetuated for, you know, thousands of years, and there's a whole race of Martians, all of whom have the same genetic defect, and suppose by now they've come down to Earth, and they're all intermingled with us, and since they're identical with us, we can't tell any difference between them. We would still have to say, by this reasoning, that these Martians, sort of scattered around the audience here, have only blockage, whereas the rest of them, you know, humans who have some other evolutionary origin, they have inaccessibility in principle. And the Martians among us are following rules, but the humans are not. In fact, it could be that that's the reality. Maybe there was an invasion, you know, 50,000 years ago of Martians with genetic defects, and now half of you are descended from Martians and half from humans. But some of you are then following rules and others aren't, and we have no way of telling. That's what we're forced to if we pursue this line of reason. And if you want to push it further, you can go further. It's sort of becomes obvious that something's gone wrong. In fact, to stop this course of absurdity from proceeding, we would have to cut it off at the first step and say there couldn't be a Martian who is just like Peter, except that he has access to consciousness. If we allow the possibility of such a species, we go off into this absurdity. So therefore, in order to block the absurdity, we have to say there couldn't be such a species. But we now have the philosopher making a very curious empirical assumption about the possibility of certain species. The philosopher is now driven to an empirical assumption that goes way beyond any biological knowledge that says certain kinds of species are impossible according to the laws of nature. Now, you know, when philosophy is driven to a crazy empirical assumption, you know that something's very wrong. And tracing it back to the origins, what's wrong is the whole idea that you're not allowed, that access to consciousness has any relation whatsoever to attributing rule following. It has no relation whatsoever to it. Therefore, we just go back to the naturalistic interpretation, and access to consciousness is an interesting question, you know, fine question, just has nothing to do with rule following and so on. Well, here again is in this naturalistic approach, which is post-Newtonian, that's the one form of post-X that I understand, so it's post-Newtonian, we just look for the best theory. We look for the best theory. And if the best theory that we can find tells us Peter's following rules, well, in Peter's following rules, we have no higher criterion to which we can appeal. In the post-Newtonian era, there is no privileged category of evidence, like, say, linguistic evidence or psychological evidence. There's no notion of philosophical explanation that goes beyond psychological hypothesis, and there's no notion of, say, blockage versus access or any such mysterious inventions which are introduced in an effort which is certain to be a vain effort to keep the whole thing from collapsing into absurdity. It just forces you into absurdity. I should say these questions have been raised to John Searle in particular, and I don't see any answers to them. Seems to me he kind of skirts the questions. Now, maybe the new book, which I haven't seen yet, says something about it, but I'll be very surprised. I doubt if anybody's seen it yet. It's just appeared. It's about the topic. But it seems to me he has to answer these questions. Unless he can answer these questions and similar one, other ones like it, the whole project totally collapses. And with it, the whole Quine project, which is based on the distinction between guiding and fitting, both of which are misinterpreted. Fitting is misinterpreted because it fails to notice that the planets fit the rules by virtue of property that they have, and guiding is misinterpreted because it's far too narrow. It's just based on the arbitrary stipulation that access to consciousness is a critical criterion, which makes no sense in the first place, and the fact that it makes no sense quickly shows up as you pursue it on the path, this and other paths, which quickly lead to absurdity. Now, in the case of the Wittgensteinian variant of this, or say Saul Kripke, who's developed it further, there's a somewhat different view of the matter. In the Wittgensteinian version, there's also a big discussion about following rules, but the examples are typically rules of arithmetic. So how do we decide? We see somebody multiplying numbers, you know, 2 times 3 equals 6, and things like that. And we see that person multiplying lots of numbers. How do we know that the person is following the rule of multiplication? How do we know that when you get to, you know, 5 times 25, it's not all of a sudden going to be, you know, 12,862? After all, that's a rule too. There's a perfectly good rule of arithmetic that says multiply the normal way up to big numbers, say, pick some point, and from that point on, make all the products equal to pi, let's say. Okay, that's a perfectly good rule of arithmetic, and how do we know that the person's not following that rule? And as Wittgenstein points out, no matter how much evidence you have, you never know that. I mean, you might decide that, you might have the hypothesis that when you get to 100, all the products go up to pi, and then when you get that far, you'll find you were wrong, but you can say, oh, it's, well, when you get to 1,000, after that, they're all equal to pi. And for every mass of evidence that you accumulate, you're always going to have these further hypotheses. So he concludes, you can never say that the person's following the rule. It's kind of like a paradox. And Kripke, in a recent book, I forget what it's called, it's Kripke's recent book on Wittgenstein. Somebody's got to remember, well, whatever. He develops this much further. Well, whatever the significance of any of this may be, we can put it aside, because the rules are not relevant. These rules are rules of a totally different category. The rules of binding theory, the rules that Peter is following, are laws of the natural world. They're like Kepler's laws or Newton's laws. It's a law of the natural world, it is claimed, that if you have a brain organized in terms of principles of binding theory embedded in a performance system of a certain type, you'll understand sentences in a certain way. That's just a more complicated variant of Newton's laws, let's say. And questions do arise about the validity of natural laws, but those are just normal questions of inductive uncertainty. And as I said at the beginning, general questions that arise for physics don't have to trouble us when we're doing psychology. You want to find the answers to those questions, go to physics. But there's no point in raising for psychology or linguistics exactly the kinds of questions of, say, inductive uncertainty or accuracy of, you know, legitimacy of theoretical postulates that arise for the most advanced sciences and arise necessarily, and in fact can't be overcome. And we know that they can't be overcome. They're just an inherent property of natural inquiry. It was well understood by the 17th century, after the Cartesian crisis of skepticism, it was well understood by people like Gassendi and others that the problems of induction are inherently insoluble. All we can do is realize that we have some method of gaining better and better understanding while knowing that it can't have any absolute grounding. We realize that. That's the result of the skeptical crisis. And that's basically the position of the natural scientist, and it's a fair position, and we can adopt it too. So those questions don't arise. As to the specific questions that arise in the case of arithmetical rules, they are irrelevant because the arithmetical rules are stipulated. Those are rules of a totally different type. They're rules which we stipulate. We stipulate that plus is going to mean so-and-so, okay? And if you don't follow that, you're just not following my stipulation. That's like turn right on red or something. know, it's a stipulation. And yeah, we can't be sure that people are following stipulations, but who cares? It's not relevant. So that kind of consideration, the Wittgenstein cryptic kind, we can put aside. We're simply concerned with rules that are of the type of natural laws, rules that Peter follows because that's the way Peter's constituted, period. Nothing more to say about it. Now, we have to be careful here to distinguish two ways in which people can follow rules. So, for example, I know that the word chair, let's say, can be used to refer to this kind of thing, but can't be used to refer to this kind of thing. Well, that's following a rule. Okay. Or I know that these sentences, which I've since erased, have the meanings that they do and not other meanings. And when I give them those meanings and use them in those ways, I'm following the rule. Now, I could choose consciously to violate those rules in a certain sense. I could use the word chair to refer to tables. In fact, we might make up a code, let's say, in which we want to confuse spies or something. And you and I might decide, okay, when we want to refer to a table, we'll say chair. Or I could take these sentences and we could make an agreement that we're going to interpret them, you know, so that the first sentence means the planes are leaving the airbase, and the second sentence means set off the bomb on the battleship or something, as in a code. We could certainly do that, and in that case, we wouldn't be following the rules. Of course, we would know, because we can't help knowing it, that chair means chair, and that the properties of reference there are the properties of reference there. But we could choose to just overlook that fact and to use these physical objects in some other fashion. Well, that's a distinction in rule following that has to be borne in mind, but it plainly has no bearing on this question. I'm turning to another example. Maybe this would be a good point to stop. I want to turn next to further examples of this dualism and continue to try to show that it indeed is all-pervasive, that virtually nothing in the field is not infected by it. But let me hold that one off till this afternoon.
And that was the reason that people were kept on the path and not the
From a naturalistic point of view, that's obviously correct. But what Quine would surely say, if you gave him that evidence, is exactly what he said when somebody pointed out to him the click evidence, that this kind of evidence does allow us to establish hypotheses. So if Karamazza has distinguished, say, in aphasia or whatever, between inflectional and derivational morphology, there's a distinction. We're allowed to attribute it to the brain. But if some linguistic theory makes crucial differences between inflectional and derivational morphology to explain linguistic phenomena, we're not allowed to do it. And I think the relationship between the categories of evidence here still is the same as in the case of the clicks. Karamazza's evidence and the evidence about WH and so on are of significance for the moment, primarily because of their correlation to the linguistic categories. I mean, if Karamazza were just to look at the brain without any idea about language, he'd find millions of different kinds of distinctions. Most of them would be totally irrelevant to anything. He picks these to be relevant because there is a reasonably well-established theory that makes those distinctions. So it's kind of like the relation between chemistry and physics 100 years ago. The chemists had very good reasons for putting things in the periodic table the way they were, and for classifying types of matter the way they did. The physicists had no special reason for why things should be that way. The chemistry was a kind of a guide to the revision of physics. Ultimately, it had to be a big revision that said, look, these are the kind of things you got to look for. You have to look for the difference between solid and liquid, you know, organized matter and non-organized matter. And you have to look for the fact that sodium is yellow, necessarily, and so on. Those are the things you have to explain. And it seems to me in the brain sciences or psychology, the way the fields are now, you know, the way the theories now stand, it's the better grounded computational representational theories, which by and large are providing the guidelines for research. But of course, the more converging evidence you get from different sources, the more irrational it becomes to take one major source of evidence and the well-established conclusions that follow from it and say that wasn't allowed. I have no idea how philosophers in this tradition are going to react to this kind of material as it continues to pile up. It's perfectly true that Wittgenstein has many cases, but all the cases fall into the notion of rule that involves norms. You know, conventional norms, community norms, something like that. As far as I know, every example is like that. That's right. Yeah, I understand. One of Wittgenstein's examples is that if I point over there, there's no way of telling from the gesture itself whether I'm pointing in that direction or in that direction. I mean, maybe when I stretch my arm that way, I mean you to extrapolate gaze backwards so that you look at what's over there. Well, Wittgenstein is not, you know, the least obscure writer in history, and it isn't very clear what he concludes from that. What he ought to conclude from it, and I don't know that this is what he does conclude, is that you extrapolate your gaze that way and not that way because that's the way we're constituted. We're built that way. That's the kind of organisms we are. We have no choice about how to interpret this gesture because it's part of our nature. So the fact that some other creature might interpret it another way is irrelevant. You know, it's like saying that in some other world, planets might not satisfy Kepler's laws. Okay, so it's just a fact about nature. It's a biological fact. Now, I don't see what that has to do with his whole story about rule following. He seems to think it means something different, but I don't know what. I don't agree with that. It's true that some of them look at your finger, but that's a matter of development. No child is taught to extrapolate gaze, to extrapolate the arm. There is a stage when, if you raise your finger, an infant will look at your finger. There's another stage when you go like this, and the child will extrapolate the length of your arm, and no instruction has taken place in between. So it's just some developmental process. Just has to be. I mean, any parents can think back and ask when they tried to teach their children that they're supposed to look that way. You know? In fact, you couldn't do it. You couldn't do it if you tried. You wouldn't know how to do it. Interestingly, young infants. It's only an infant. An infant will look at your finger. But as soon as the child has matured properly, the child starts pointing before people do. One of the earliest actions of children is to point and ask for the name. You know, and at that point, they're already using gestures as pointing gestures. In fact, there's been some study of this. There's a very interesting study, but mostly by a woman named Laura. Where are the double T's? I keep forgetting. Two T's? Petito. Two T's?
First time one.
Okay. Now, Laura Petito, who's been studying, she was particularly interested in development of sign in children. And she discovered some quite remarkable things about pointing in extremely young children, like children a year old and so on. It turns out, in sign language, like, say, American Sign Language, pointing gestures are used for reference, like you is that and me is this. Okay, so pointing gestures have referential content. But it turns out that those referential gestures, which are like pronouns, develop quite separately from the normal pointing gesture, you know, pointing at something because you want somebody to look over there. In fact, they develop so separately that they sometimes work in contradiction. There's an early stage of child language, which anybody who's watched children remembers, where a child will use the pronoun you to refer to himself and refer to I to refer to you. And it's sort of obvious why. You know, the child hears himself referred to as you, so he figures that's my name, you know. And he receives that person referred to as I, so he figures that's your name. So there is a stage that children go through where they invert the pronouns. I is that person over there, and you is me. So a child will say, pick you up, meaning pick me up. Okay. That's standard, in fact, virtually universal. Well, it turns out that the signing kids use the sign symbols counter iconically. That is, they use this symbol to refer to you and that symbol to refer to me. Counter iconically. At the same time that when they're pointing, they use them iconically. Okay? And these systems develop in parallel, though they mean opposite things at this stage. Now, in both the development of gesture and straight gesture in deaf children and hearing children, the development is exactly the same and completely independent of any parental interaction. It nevertheless does remain true that if you take a six-month-old infant and you stick out your finger, the infant will look at your finger. But that's just a developmental fact. I mean, there comes a point where, in fact, infants even extrapolate eye gaze. So an infant will look at you can be looking at something, and the infant at some level will look at you and look at the thing you're looking at. That's a pretty amazing computation. I think that other primates aren't capable of that, as far as anybody knows. And notice that that's a crucial prerequisite to learning names. You have to know what the person's attending to. So if the mother is looking at that, the child can look at the mother's eye and figure out that the mother's looking that way, and will then look that way. So it's not, and certainly no child has ever taught that. I mean, that's out of the question. But that's just another form of extrapolation of arm. So all of this thing comes along. It all comes very early, very, very early. It sometimes even works contrary to picking up of referential gestures, as in the sign case. It just looks like normal biological development, like learning to walk. I mean, children aren't taught to walk. They just walk at a certain stage. True, at an earlier stage, they crawl, but they're not taught to walk. And similarly, at an early stage, they look at your finger. At a later stage, they extrapolate arms, but they're never taught to do it. And in fact, the effort to teach would be impossible. You know, nobody could even dream up a teaching procedure that would work. This eye gaze business is kind of amazing, in fact. As you all know, when you can look at a person and you know when they're looking at you, and some sort of instinctive reaction that we have, which must go way back in evolutionary history, prevents us from looking at people. Because if you're talking to somebody and you look into their eye and you see that they're looking at you, somehow that establishes too much intimacy or something, and you have to look away. So your automatic reaction is to look away. And if you keep looking, it's frightening. It frightens the person if you keep looking. I mean, unless there's some special relation of intimacy or something like that. And these are extremely subtle calculations. I mean, to decide whether a person is looking at you requires a very precise calculation. You know? And the whole instinctive background that tells us how to respond to it, you know, like looking a little bit away when you're talking to somebody, it must be very deep in our evolutionary history. And actually, the neurophysiologist should assume the same thing. I mean, it's extremely easy. There's nothing easier than to do irrelevant experiments. In fact, most experiments are just irrelevant. You know, if you pick an experiment at random and you do it, you'll get meaningless data. It takes an awful long time to get data that actually means something. So, say, take the click experiments. I mean, it's not that Tom Bever and Jerry Fodor decided to study click displacement and found this thing. What happened is they had this idea that maybe there would be click displacement. And they did experiments and they came out with completely crazy results. So they changed the experiments and then they came out with better results. And they kept refining the experiments until they had found experiments that gave them what they knew had to be true, namely that you get displacement to the phrase boundary. And an awful lot of experimental work is like that. I mean, they don't tell you about that when they write a scientific paper. But anybody who's an experimental scientist knows perfectly well that an enormous part of the effort is trying to find an experiment that's not stupid, because most experiments are just stupid. You know, and if somebody comes along with a stupid experiment that says, I can't find any relation between this and that, the usual answer is go back and design a better experiment. One of the things you learn as an experimental scientist, is that the process of designing a correct experiment is like the process of designing a good theory. It's very similar. They don't just come along. You've got to refine them and modify them and see what's going wrong and eliminate interfering factors. And ultimately, if you're lucky, you'll get an experiment which shows something. And usually that means bears on some theoretical assumption. Now, in the case of the inflection and derivation, there is a theoretical assumption, namely that they're different. And there's a lot of evidence for it. So the neurophysiologist will try to find experiments that show something going on in the brain that correlates to that. There are millions of experiments that will show no correlation. In fact, almost anyone you do at random will show no correlation. Well, let's go back to the concrete case. So let's take the example that I gave. Okay. He thinks John is intelligent. His mother thinks John is intelligent. Now, if Peter says that, if Peter says this one, I know that Peter is intending to refer to two different people, one of them John, and one whoever he is in this discourse. Okay. If Peter says this one, I don't know that. He might be intending to refer to two different people, or he might be intending that this pronoun refers to John. Okay, he might be. So I know something about the meaning of those two cases. That's just a fact. You know, it's like the fact that sodium is yellow. Okay, just a phenomenon. You can make that fact as reliable as you like. You know, do the very tight experiments. You find it in other languages, you know, and so on. So without knowing Catalan, you know, something similar will be true. You know. So we have a fact. All right, there is a theory called binding theory, which deals with a wide array of facts of that type. There's a whole mass of them. They have to do with pronominal dependence, the conditions under which a pronoun can be dependent, can pick up its reference from something else. And it's a rich theory with a lot of results. All right, Dummett is willing to agree to that. He says that this theory is a psychological hypothesis. In fact, even if we improved this theory, we expanded it so that it didn't only cover these phenomena, but it covered all phenomena of language, it would still just be a psychological hypothesis. And even if we improved this theory further so that we related it to, you know, activities of cells, we said that when I make this judgment, the cells in my brain are doing so-and-so, and when I make this judgment, the cells in my brain are doing such-and-such. And some arrangement of cells expresses this. Even if we did all of that, we'd still only have a psychological hypothesis. We would not yet have a philosophical explanation for meaning. That's his claim. And his claim is that we cross that bridge from psychological hypothesis to philosophical explanation only when the person is guided in Quine's sense. That is, can tell us that these are the rules they're following. So if the Martian can introspect and say, I'm following the rules of binding theory, then we have a philosophical explanation. We know the form in which the knowledge is presented. Otherwise, we don't. And if we've crossed that bridge, we're now allowed to attribute knowledge to Peter. We're allowed to say Peter knows the principles of the binding theory. If we haven't crossed that bridge, we're not allowed to do it. Well, as far as I can see, you can look at these, at this theory in two different ways. You can say it's just a bunch of terminological stipulations. Okay. In that case, it's of no interest. I mean, if that's what philosophers want to say, if that's the way they want to use words in the Oxford Senior Common Room, fine. You know, it has nothing to do with knowledge. It has nothing to do with people. It has nothing to do with rule following. It just has to do with certain odd conventions in Oxford Senior Common Rooms, like whether you, which are on a par with whether you drink port before meals or after meals. It's something like that. On the other hand, if they think they're saying something that has some significance, either for philosophy or for science or for human life and so on, then they have a lot of explaining to do. They have to explain why any of this matters. And they also have to explain their way out of strange paradoxes that result if you pursue it, like the case that I went through in the Searle case. So I think they have a lot of explanation to do. Either it's just terminological stipulation, or else there's some explaining to do. Now, nobody has tried the explanation. It's considered self-evident. So, for example, in Dummett's latest book, which is the one I'm quoting from, he sort of just presents this as a kind of side comment on why he rejects linguistic explanations in the theory of meaning. He says, well, we obviously reject these because they don't tell us the form in which knowledge is presented and therefore don't give us philosophical explanations. But that's not enough. You know, and that's not, it's not enough to reject it that way. There are questions to answer. Now, I think if we sort of think it about the cultural history of philosophy, we can guess what the explanations are. You know, this is now trying to look at philosophy the way a cultural anthropologist would look at a tribe in Central Australia. You know, we can try to figure out how they're getting to the curious positions that they're getting to. And I think it's easy. It's, if you know the background, you can sort of see it. You can see what might have led somebody to this position. Part of what's leading to that position is a classical education. Almost all of these people have gone through a classical education. In a classical education, you're taught something about language. I mentioned yesterday, I forget when, was it here or somebody else? I mentioned to someone yesterday that I had just come from Oxford where I was talking about these things. And after a lot of discussion about it in the senior common room, which is where everybody's life goes on, a very distinguished philosopher told me that he thinks all the stuff we're doing is kind of interesting, but it's not about language. Because the only language is Attic Greek. That's the only language. And that's the one he learned when he was a student at Oxford. Now, Attic Greek is an interesting... Why is Attic Greek a language? Well, because there's a fixed, closed text. You know, there's a, it's finished. You know, you can say, here it is. It's these texts. Furthermore, there's a bunch of guys who wrote some rules, and they say these are the rules of Attic Greek. Now, in fact, those rules come nowhere near describing the texts, but they don't know that, because they didn't think about syntax and semantics and so on. The rules, in fact, describe very peripheral aspects of the text. But you're not taught that when you get a classical education. What you're taught is memorize these texts, memorize the rules determine the texts. Rule, when you have a composition, like you have to write a composition for your teacher, you're supposed to follow the rules in the sense of putting together the constructions the way it says in that rule book. Okay. And I think that's the model people have in mind. Okay. Well, if you have that model in mind, you could very well be led to this. I mean, the model is, you know, completely wild. You know? But if that's the model that you have in mind, you could very well be led to these conceptions of rule following, language, knowledge. See, in the case of knowledge of Attic Greek, what it would mean is having memorized those rules. The rules are there in a book, and you got to study them if you want to, you know, get a high degree at Oxford. and you memorize the rules, and you know them all by heart, and then you know Attic Greek. Okay? And I think that's the model that people have in mind. And that carries over to all of these discussions. Literature. Real-time experiments. Well, I think that's the kind of thing that Luigi was actually referring to. Real-time linguistic processing, you know, has the usual problems. It's easy to do irrelevant experiments. And it's only quite recently that people have started doing experiments which are quite intriguing. So, for example, there's experiments on what's called priming effects. Okay, so you play a signal to somebody, and at some point you ask them a question about something that happened before. You know, I mean, you can ask the question sort of indirectly, like maybe some word appeared here, and you give them another word that's in the same semantic category. And you ask how long it takes to remember for them to find it or something. Well, what's been done is to take various what are called empty elements that are there in the mental representation but don't have any sound. You don't pronounce them. So there are empty, like in Catalan, for example, there are empty pronouns. You mean he, but you don't say it. You know, you just say nothing. And there's a whole variety of these things that have different types. In linguistic theory, they fall into many different categories. For example, if you say, who did John see? There's good reason to believe that there's an empty category over here and that you're interpreting who as being a kind of an operator binding a variable which is actually here. And there's good reason to believe that in the mental representation, it is actually there. The mind sees it. It's only that the voice doesn't pronounce it. Okay. Well, and there's a number of different types. Well, the priming experiments, which are real-time processing, have gotten sophisticated enough so they're beginning to be able to make distinctions between the kind of priming of earlier things that you could ask about a pronoun and its antecedent, or one of these things, and the quantifier, and all these relationships. And they're beginning to find different kinds of relationships for different kinds of elements. Okay, that's real-time processing work that's very intriguing. It's intriguing, again, for the same reason. It's beginning to give evidence about processing, which is meaningful evidence, because it correlates with categories that are pretty firmly established from other points of view. Now, notice that there could well come a time when this evidence gets good enough so that you'll rely on it to change the linguistic theories. Okay, that could well happen. So, for example, if linguists postulate two different kinds of empty elements, and priming studies show that they always work exactly the same way, as distinct from others, well, the linguists are going to have to rethink it. Maybe they made a mistake. You know? So there will come a time when, maybe it's there already, when the real-time processing experiments could very well bear on the theory of the computational structure. And that's one of the many, many areas of interaction which are very fruitful now. Luigi mentioned brain studies, child acquisition studies, real-time processing. All of this material is beginning to interact in ways that bear on the same questions from quite different points of view. And, of course, that's very important. You know, then you can get confirmation and disconfirmation and new ideas and so on from other areas of evidence.